Welcome to How I Raised It, the podcast that goes behind the scenes with entrepreneurs who've raised capital. We uncover the tips, tricks, and techniques they use to get investors to write a check. Strap in and turn it up.
Hi, welcome to another episode of How I Raised It. Today with me is Jeff Kripe of Cargo, coming to us from New York. How's your day going, Jeff?
Going really well, but I've been looking forward to doing this.
Awesome. Jeff was a few minutes late because he just came from a VC meeting. So it's, you know, this is great. This is like real time funding advice, you know, as it's happening, as it's unfolding. So so what is Cargo and how'd you come up with the idea for this business?
Yeah, so the way we describe ourselves is we're essentially an in-car commerce platform for the rideshare economy. So what we do is we provide a hardware and software enabled device that we install in rideshare vehicles by shipping directly to the driver. And with that hardware and software, passengers are able to order and receive in real time from their drivers consumer goods products that can be anything from electronics like iPhone chargers and cell phones and cell phone chargers and things like that to, you know, premium cosmetics or snacks or Advil or hangover cures or weird Korean face masks. It's meant to be a moment of sort of like tapping into like what you actually need on a daily basis when you're in a rideshare vehicle, as well as like something you might want to discover with that passive time in the vehicle.
Interesting. And so all these products are kept in inventory in the car. I mean, the passengers aren't ordering these ahead of time, are they?
Not yet. That's something we're interested in doing through partnerships with different rideshare companies, allowing you to actually pre-order a product and having it, you know, sort of ready inside the vehicle, whether that's, you know, having your driver pick up a Starbucks for you or just, you know, tapping into the inventory that we in the car and saying, hey, I'm on the way to the airport. I don't have time to go to a Duane Reade. Your driver would just have an iPhone charger, you know, that we've pre-supplied them with waiting inside the vehicle. So that's something we're interested in doing. But, you know, the primary business for us right now is actually, I actually have one here with me, is basically a piece of hardware that mounts on top of the center console inside the vehicle, is lit up, has charge ports on the front, products that are filled in there. You can see iPhone chargers, you can see snacks, you can see two charge ports on the front, and you can see funny Korean face masks, which are a hit with women and probably quite a few men as well. Different types of sort of like confections, Red Bull, energy drinks, gum, any sort of need state that you can imagine yourself being in inside of a vehicle is something that we think we can probably solve for you.
That's very interesting. It's this is maybe going to date me, but back when I was going to clubs in my 20s, you know, you'd have kind of the usually a female, I think they were called cigarette girls, that would walk around with the trays of, you know, cigarettes and like just little knickknacks, odds and ends that you sort of need. I think condoms and things like that, right? And they walk around. So it's kind of that concept. How did you come up with this idea? I mean, it's pretty obvious in like retrospect, but it's also pretty clever.
Yeah. You know, we looked at, I think like a retailer. So, when I looked at how big Uber and Lyft had gotten in 2015, the first thing I thought was that's a massive distribution opportunity. And vending machine businesses are typically pretty good businesses. They return capital pretty quickly and reliably. If you've sort of forecasted sales well, the margins are quite good. They throw off a lot of cash. And, you know, drivers were and are hungry for additional income. We sort of had a built-in service personnel inside the vehicle, you know, the driver who could actually manage the inventory if we could resupply it to them cost efficiently. So the mechanics were sort of all there. And we tested the idea out in New York City with a couple of acrylic boxes inside of VIA cars in New York, if you're familiar with that rideshare service. And something like 8.5% of people were actually purchasing things that we'd sort of put inside the vehicle, which, you know, if you're a retail guy like me, 8.5% of conversion is unbelievable. And it was a really bootleg operation that was done with like Square credit card readers, laminated signage that I made at Kinko's, and and some acrylic boxes I'd bought on Amazon filled with products I'd bought on Amazon, including some fake Apple products at the time. And things were just flying off the shelf. So we said, okay, we've got something here. We don't know what we have, but the data is really good. So why don't we, you know, we applied to Techstars. I knew as a first-time founder that going through an accelerator program, especially a prestigious one, would be good for one, learning how to really sort of get a company off the ground, but two, you know, and it's, this is relevant to this conversation, like really improving my fundraising chops. And both of those things proved to be true. Probably the biggest thing that came out of it, though, was I stopped thinking just like a retailer and started thinking like a retailer operating within this new sort of emerging mobility space. And what occurred to us is that the big idea here is not creating a massive vending machine company. The big idea here is owning the experience inside of the vehicle. Because as we go from a driver and car ownership based economy to a shared car economy and eventually to an autonomous economy, we're going to be passengers more often than we're drivers. As that happens, as we go from 15 million rideshare rides today that are given on a daily basis to something like 100 million by 2030 on a daily basis, all of that time spent in vehicles is time where passengers could be engaging with different forms of media or entertainment or commerce or other things. So for us, we really want to use this piece of hardware and the software and the brand equity and the rideshare relationships that we have to establish ourselves as like the premium and go-to provider for in-car goods and services generally. And that's how we think of it today.
It's very interesting. I wanted to get to the funding because that's what this show is about, but it's such a, I'm curious about your business. Do you have to strike a deal with Uber and Lyft to get in these cars, or is this, I mean, these are independent contractors, so it's really just the drivers themselves that you have to win over, or both?
It's the drivers. It's both. But actually, you know, we've got 22,000 signups now. 70% of those have been driver-to-driver referrals or organic signups through PR or other forms of awareness. 30% of those have come from rideshare partnerships, from paid marketing, which we do, frankly, very little of. Or some paid influencer marketing. Believe it or not, there are rideshare influencers, and we work with some of those guys. So it's really about the driver. But you know, obviously, if you can get into, you know, we have relationships with Uber. We're integrated with their API, and if we can effectively use them as a marketing companion, you know, that'll be even better for the business. So it's some of both.
Okay. It's really cool. I could ask you a million questions about your business, but I want to be respectful of your time. So you got into Techstars. What was that, New York or Boulder, or which program was it?
We applied to, I want to say when you apply, we applied in 2016, in May, February of 2016. We were admitted in May of 2016, a couple months later. And we applied to a couple different programs. I think we applied to New York, which was sort of like the general accelerator, the Minneapolis program, which was retail focused, and the mobility program in Detroit. And that was the one we really liked, even though it was a little bit newer. And that's ultimately the one that we were admitted to. So we went there, quit my job the day I got into the accelerator. And I had a very supportive boss. So I didn't leave him hanging, and, you know, I didn't leave him hanging. He was excited for us. Quit the job. 2 weeks later, moved to Detroit. Had an awesome time in Detroit. It's like, it really is an up and coming city. It's a terrific city. And you know, that's where I would say I would attribute a lot of our success, honestly, to Techstars, in terms of helping us get some initial funding, really making us an investable company, pairing us up with Cooley, who has been our legal counsel since day one, who, you know, help us, you know, transform ourselves from an LLC into a C corp, you know, who really, in a number of different ways, from team to product to counsel to administrative stuff, made us an actual investable company. That's where we kind of got our legs and got the foundation.
Cool. So that was, you got accepted in May. When did the program run?
So we got accepted late May. It started, I want to say, like June 16th and went through like September 10th.
Got it. Okay. And then out of that, so that was the, you know, the capital they put in. Then did you raise an angel round while you're in the program, or what was the next funding event?
We did, actually. Yeah. So Techstars, when you go into Techstars, I don't know if they still do it the same way today, but when we did, they put $20,000 in cash for a defined equity piece in the company, and then you have the option to take a $100,000 convertible note on like a $3 million cap. So we took that note and we basically said, well, it's a little dilutive, but the nice thing is that somebody just basically set a valuation for us. So we used that to raise another $130,000 on the same terms. And we did that in the program just to have some operating capital. We didn't really tap into it except for to pay for our rent while we were there, which was like $900 a month because we chose to live in the suburbs. And really just kind of kept that in the bank. And my goal, one of my personal KPIs while going through the program, was to raise a seed round immediately after the program. The program ended in September, and we had been warned that if you're going to try and raise capital, you've got to raise it before Thanksgiving, because after Thanksgiving, it's nearly impossible to get a deal done. So I basically knew, you knew it normally takes 3 to 6 months to raise a round. So I started raising, you know, pretty much as soon as we got into the program. And that ended up working out pretty well for us. I became a much better fundraiser in the program. And I think by the time demo day came around on September 9th or 10th, we had 800,000 committed or 900,000 committed. And by November 4th of 2016, we closed our seed round, which was including the $250,000 convertible note that converted in the seed round. It was a $1.75 million seed.
That's great. So let's unpack that a little bit. One of these phrases that seems to be popular. You started fundraising the day you got in there, basically. Tell me kind of on a day-to-day basis, what were you doing to find investors, get the introductions, generate interest, you know, take us through a day in the life of Jeff.
Yeah. The first thing that, you know, I would say started was like preparing to be a better fundraiser. And one of the things that really helped with that was Techstars and sort of like this video tutorial that we went through, and then actually sort of like a role-playing tutorial with David Cohen, the founder of Techstars. And without sort of trying to rehearse all of it, because it was a 2.5 hour long session, the main principle was when you are first raising a round of financing, you have no leverage to talk about pricing. So don't talk about pricing. When I have nobody committed to our round, I have no leverage over that investor to say, hey, we command if we're raising a seed round, a $6 million post-money valuation, because nobody else is willing to pay that right now. So the big thing that we learned was try to go out there and start with people who are pretty warm on you. Maybe that's friends and family. Maybe that's investors who followed you for the past 7 months. You've kept up to date on newsletters and other things. Go to them and basically say, look, you know how hard it is to get that initial commitment, but once you have a third to a fourth committed, things start to pick up steam. So I'd really love for you to commit to this round, give me an amount that you're willing to commit, and tell me any conditions that are there. Do you want us to be located in a certain city? Do you need me to have a certain type of co-founder? Do the terms need to be a certain thing? So you de-risk that investment for them. You don't actually ask them to wire the capital or anything, but they've hard committed to that round, assuming that you satisfy the conditions that they've attached to their commitment. And you start building that, you know, portfolio of interest. So, you know, what we had by the time demo day rolled around was $750,000 or $800,000 in these commitments. And some people had certain conditions and some had others. But the interesting thing that happened was as soon as we got to $1 million or 1.25 in committed capital and then found a lead that pushed us to 1.5, everybody, we now had momentum and we had pricing leverage and we were interesting and we were a hot company. And all of those conditions, oh, you need to be in this city. Oh, you need to have this team member. Oh, you need to be doing X, you know, $100,000 of revenue by the end of the year. All of those conditions fell away because I now had leverage and I had momentum. And that's when we finally started to talk about price. So if I could boil all that down, it would be secure interest before you talk about price with investors. And that was the first thing that we learned. And I swear to God, my hit rate with investors went from like 1 out of every 10 to like, I had like a better, better than a coin toss of a chance walking into a room and closing a deal.
That's really great. I mean, that's golden. What the last 5 minutes is golden. This is amazing, amazing stuff. That's really fantastic. Did any of those conditions stick around? I mean, was there any sour grapes with any of these guys? Like, hey, you told me you would stay in Detroit or whatever the condition was, or literally once you had that momentum.
Because they had an out. What investors like to do is they like to tiptoe up to the line and they like to say yes, or let's continue the conversation, which means no, by the way. And they preserve optionality, right? So I gave these guys all an out. So they knew that if we didn't do everything they wanted, they could say, hey, Jeff, you know, I know you did two out of these three things, but you didn't do this thing. And so I'm out now. So they all had that optionality, but they chose not to exercise that option because they now wanted to be part of the deal because it was a hot deal. And they wanted to be the ones that could say, hey, I saw this deal first. I invested. I was one of the first or second investors. I'm in this. And that's how they, you know, in addition to measuring outcomes and exits, you know, it's, you want to be the first investor in Uber. You don't want to be the Series E investor in Uber. You know what I mean? So there's, you know, there's value in that. And there's a lot of sort of psychology behind fundraising that, was really helpful to learn. So the first thing I did was learn how to fundraise. And it is something that can be learned and taught. The second thing was starting a pipeline. So what our managing director recommended that we do, and we took this pretty seriously, was go make a list of all of the people that. And track their minimum allocation and their maximum allocation. And if you know you need to get to 6 million, you know the minimum and maximum allocation of each of those investors. And you know the,
Can you just repeat that? It froze for one sec. So just repeat the second thing to do is start a pipeline. Just pick up with the second thing to do if you don't mind.
Yeah. So, you know, after learning how to fundraise, the second thing you need to do is identify a pipeline of investors that you can actually go out and either speak to because you have intros or seek intros to. So that's what we did. We started, you know, honestly, just, I didn't use HubSpot, I didn't use Salesforce. We just, you know, we just used an Excel document. And the Excel document basically was name of investor, are they a VC, are they an angel, type of investor, where they're located, what their minimum and maximum allocations are, where in the deal cycle with them are we, and what is the likelihood that that translates to an investment? And you assign it a probability. And at the bottom of that, you know you need to raise $1.5 million. So you basically have a pipeline of 50 investors, their minimum and maximum allocations, and probabilities assigned that each investment is going to be a yes, a no, maybe whatever. And you see if, you know, the number of meetings that you can potentially set up based on those probabilities will result in a $1.5 million raise. And you know that you need to enlarge your pipeline or you've got too much in your pipeline. And then you start with sort of like, you know, the warm folks and you start to try and build that Rolodex of interest again. So once we had the pipeline, that's when we started going out and actually securing meetings. And Techstars was helpful for that. Our law firm was helpful for that. And frankly, like investors are the best way to get to other investors. And whether, you know, an investor passes on you or they say, let's come, you know, let's do another meeting at the end of it, always say, hey, you know, we're raising this round. Do you know anybody else who'd be interested in taking a meeting and leverage that? So it was about, you know, identifying the pipeline and then actually building out the connections to execute on the pipeline.
How did you determine minimum and maximum allocation? I think your whole pipeline approach and probability is very interesting, but how did you figure out that part?
You just ask, or you go on, you spend a bunch of time on Crunchbase and you look at, you know, what stage does this firm usually participate? And usually firms self-identify as we're seed series stage. We're a series seed venture firm. We don't lead. That means they're writing $100,000 to $250,000 checks. Or we're a series A company. Or we do both, but we typically only lead. That means they're writing $500 to $1 million checks. You know, you ask and you look on Crunchbase and you do your research. And it's not only also about like, what does that partner do? If you're talking, or excuse me, what does that firm typically do? If you're talking to a big firm, you need to look at like what that partner typically invests. Mm-hmm. So it's really about asking because all of the partners have different sort of, you know, levels for the most part that they can sort of like execute deals on, and different firms have different ways to sort of consecrate deals. Some firms need to have 100% partner buy-in. Some, you know, firms, the partners have the ability to write up to a certain amount of check size without necessarily getting full partner buy-in. So honestly, it's just about asking.
Yeah, those are great.
Documenting the responses as well.
No, that's great. That's really good. I think founders often don't do enough asking and their own due diligence and probing. You know, you spend an hour meeting and 55 minutes of that is talking about your pitch and answering their questions, but you need to have, you know, 15, 20 minutes to carve off to really ask all those questions you just posed. Do you have a sense or do you recall how many total investors you talked to and how many ended up coming in on that round?
Yeah, it was probably, All in all, we probably met with 45 firms, and I think we had 7 on the cap table by the end of it, and more said yes than that, but not everybody made it into the round. So we probably ended up converting 25 to 30% into participants. And then, you know, fewer than that actually ended up on the cap table.
Did you have a lead, or was this kind of a party round?
We did have a lead. Rosecliff Ventures, New York City fund, focuses almost exclusively on consumer, led the round.
Great. Okay. Rosecliff. I'm not familiar with them. And so it sounds like it was oversubscribed, magic words, right? For any round.
Yep.
How did you pick who to let in, and how do you message? I mean, this is a nice problem to have, right? But how did you message to the ones that couldn't make it in?
It was really about, we were pretty explicit when we started raising capital about what investors we wanted on our cap table. And it was people that had logistic experience, people who are really deep on consumer retail, people who were sort of, you know, really knowledgeable about mobility. So, you know, Fontanelle's partners, Bill Ford's investment arm participated, really deep on mobility. Mm. Blue Capital in New York City participated. You know, the founder of that fund and 2 or 3 of the partners there ran one of the largest distributors of Western food goods into China. So when it came to CPG logistics, like, these guys are top notch. Techstars Ventures participated. That relationship really drove their investment, just because we had gone through Techstars, and they're just a really good generalist fund. And then Rosecliff, you know, they're all about, like, consumers. So I think that, you know, they were into Allbirds, they're into Juice Press, they're into a bunch of really good consumers companies. So it, you know, for a couple of them, it was, you know, they may not have sort of fit the mold, and it was pretty easy to explain. And then for some of them, it was just, you know, we spent a lot of time building relationships with VCs. You need to make sure that you're comfortable and excited about everybody on your cap table. So for some of them, we didn't feel like it was the right fit. We probably made up an excuse. And then some of them, it was just order. Like, they came in at the end, and we were already sort of fully allocated.
Yeah, no, that's great. It sounds like, you know, you have some good depth of talent and experience around the table. I'm assuming only one of those firms has a board seat. So how, and correct me if I'm wrong, but how are you tapping all that other experience and knowledge? How are you leveraging all these investors with all the consumer product and distribution experience?
Yeah. So I'm a pretty communicative founder. One of the best hacks that I've found is sending out a monthly newsletter to investors who are on your cap table, investors who passed on you but are interested, family, friends, people who are just in the space and interested in what you're doing. You send a monthly newsletter out, you break it down by sort of, like, business component. Here's how, for us, you know, driver supply is going. Here's how brand partnerships are going. Here's how logistics are going. Here's how hardware is going. Here's how software is going. And you just sort of keep people, in a non-proprietary way, sort of apprised of what you're doing, and you stay top of mind with those people. So I think communication is the first step. Then we also have a monthly board meeting, and we have an investor update that is specific to investors with a bunch of proprietary information that we distribute to all of our investors. So one is just communication. Like, they've got a bunch of portfolio companies. You're probably one of 25 deals that the partner has. You know, depending on the size of the firm. So you need to be top of mind with them so that when things come across their table, they think to ping you about it. The other thing is just, you know, making sure you know. I always ask them, like, so what are you interested in helping with? Because nobody's going to want to help if they're not interested in helping on that particular topic. So I try to ask, like, what do you want to help with? And then I know when I have a certain problem, I go to that person for that ask.
Yeah, that's great.
I think it's a lot of communication and just sort of, like, question asking, really. Apart from that, like, you just will develop stronger connections with some people than others. Like, you know, I have somebody who, in terms of, you know, we've had people that have written, you know, $2 million checks now to us. But somebody who's only in the cap table for 200K is probably my closest investor. He's like my, you know, psychologist almost. When I'm thinking through deal, honestly, when I'm thinking through deal strategy or tough hiring things, when to fundraise or what to target or how to work with VCs or how to, he's the person I go to. And you'll just start to sort of get a sense for who can be helpful to you where.
That's fantastic. So have we covered all your rounds? Or I know you just announced a new, a fairly new one too. Have we covered that already? Or is that a...
So the seed round that we did was in November of 2016, and that was a $1.75 million round, institutional led. The round we just announced, we closed almost a year to the day later in November of 2017, and we just announced it in January now of 2018, so last month, you know, a couple of weeks ago. And that was a $5.5 million round, that all institutional, for the most part. There was a little bit of sort of, you know, strategic angel money in there, but pretty much all institutional. And that round was led by CRCM Ventures based out of San Francisco, with participation from Kellogg's as a strategic, and who's one of our biggest clients.
Kellogg's the cereal maker.
Yeah, you know, they've got a massive portfolio that, you know, is snack bars, and they just bought our X Bar, one of the, you know, the fastest growing sort of healthy protein bars. I mean, they've got a Rice Krispies, you know, Cheez-Its, I mean, Pringles, huge portfolio. But, you know, in terms of consumer packaged goods companies that are really innovative, progressive, interested in new distribution channels, they're a great fit for us.
That's interesting. Let's touch on that for a minute. So, did you conscientiously set out to have a strategic investor like that, or did it just sort of happen organically?
It just happened. I actually really didn't want a strategic investor. Strategic investors are tough. I think they're better sort of like post Series B once you know exactly what your business is. I think sometimes strategics can get on the cap table thinking they're in for one thing, and then the business may change over time, as startups are wont to do. And they're now invested in something completely different that maybe is delivering less strategic value to them than they initially thought. For us, however, we have a bunch of different types of partners, right? We have rideshare partners who we have brand partners, we have logistics partners. You know, for us, it was really a no-brainer once we got into it with Kellogg's that it wouldn't be competitive, it wouldn't be a poison pill, and we were always going to have a need for what they could bring to the table. And they're just good investors who, you know, didn't want to, you know, control the cap table. They just ended up being really good venture investors and a good fit for us. So it was something I was notionally almost against to begin with, but I'm really happy that it's worked out the way that it has.
You're not restricted from carrying Procter & Gamble products or whatever.
No, honest to God, they participated in the round in the same way every other venture investor participated in the round. We don't expect them to hand out business to us. They're our biggest client, but they may choose to stop working with us. I shouldn't say they may. I don't think they have any intentions of doing that. But if they did, my point being, we don't have any specific sort of, you know, if you invest, then you need to do this much business with us. There are no sort of conditions, and they haven't said we'll only invest if you keep, you know, our competitors out of the box. Like, it, you know, it was a total straightforward venture investment. Yeah. And that was important to us, and I think important to them too, because once you start to sort of tie each other's hands behind the back, I think is when you have more potential for people to get frustrated and constrained and annoyed. So fortunately, yeah, ours, you know, the conversation with them didn't go that way.
Did you do anything different raising this this most recent round versus what you did in the first round, or kind of the same playbook?
It's different in the sense that your seed round, when you're raising it based basically on like charisma and vision and like a little bit of metrics. Like, we were pre-launch when we raised our seed round, so it was really based on those three things. Like, that was all about herding cats, right? So we were basically trying to source, you know, warm leads, build momentum, and then, you know, like we talked about earlier, create pricing leverage, set a price, and you know, with the lead that we brought in, and the lead came last for us. With this new round, it was almost inverted in the sense that we now had to raise $5 to $6 million, and our target ended up being $5 million. And when you're trying to raise $5 million, what I did was I went to all of my existing investors who we had established really good relationships. Unfortunately, we'd had a really good year where we delivered literally or exceeded everything, exceeded all of our key targets. I said, "Hey guys, we're raising this round. Where are we at in terms of pro rata?" And I called everybody and I said, "Hey, I would love to have you participate. You know, we think we're going to have solid interest for this round, but, you know, it's important for us to keep our existing investors involved. So let me know what you're on pro rata. And I think every single investor on the cap table participated, and four took super pro rata. So doubled the allocation, or, you know, incrementally increased the allocation that they sort of had guaranteed to them. So I started with existing investors, and that gave me a platform when I went out to new investors to say, hey, we've already got 2 million of this $5 million round done. If we can get a lead for 2 million, all we need to do is come up with another million, which I'm confident I have because I've talked to these several firms and I'm sure you guys have some buddies that you like to do deals with. So I started with existing investors as a base, and then I went for the lead and I lined up 20 meetings in Silicon Valley, and I pinged a bunch of the New York firms that we're close with to let them know I was going to the Valley so they would start to feel competitive with the firms because they didn't want to lose a New York deal to a West Coast investor. But I went out there first. I took 20 meetings. Two of those ended up yielding a term sheet, and came back and got the lead done. And then it was just about picking with that lead who we wanted to fill out the other million. So, you know, the order of operations was different. It was less like herding cats and more like lining up the foundation with your pro rata, securing a lead, doing that sort of second, and then filling out the rest of the round with your lead and finding somebody that you're both excited about and comfortable with.
And your lead, is that a West Coast or did you stay with East Coast, New York lead?
So we ended up with two term sheets, one from a firm based on the East Coast and West Coast with sort of equal sized offices in both, big, you know, multi-billion dollar fund, and one from CRCM Ventures, who ultimately led our round. And ultimately that was sort of the better fit and the timing was right, and went with them. And they're based out of the West Coast, and interestingly enough, their CRCM stands for China Rock Capital Management. So they're actually, you know, pretty heavily involved and have businesses in China as well. So one of the things that we're interested in eventually is Asia as a growth market. China is probably a little tougher, but Southeast Asia in particular is interesting. And they have a lot of experience bringing Western companies over into Asia and sort of helping them build out there. So that's one of the things that was really about us about them.
That's really interesting, yeah. On that note, just a couple more questions, I'll let you go. On that note, are you seeing competitors emerge in other regions? You know, you sort of saw that's with the ride sharing companies, right? You've got all these fairly large ride sharing companies sprouting up, raising lots of money. Are you seeing anything like this happening in your space? And if so, how does it affect your funding strategy? Do you think you need to go raise? Do you feel pressure to go raise a lot of money?
So let me tackle the first part. Are we seeing any competition? In the U.S., no. I'm sure there are companies out there that are just kind of flying under the radar that we don't know about. We know the market pretty well, but I'm sure there's somebody out there working on something trying to raise money. And you know, I'm always worried that tomorrow I'm going to hear that Sequoia just dumped $25 million into a, you know, cargo competitor. But you know, yeah. Hopefully that doesn't happen. So one is we're aware of it. There doesn't seem to be anything in the U.S. Two is there is a company in China. That is developed a really similar business down to the icons on our website. We're aware of them. China is a crazy place. There's a lot of capital. I think they've now raised $13 million in 5 months. We're very much the market leader in the U.S. We're the team leader. We're the product leader. But they've now raised more money than us. So it definitely gets the competitive juices flowing a little bit. I think it's good to have competition that validates the market. Like we're doing something totally, totally new, right? Like there's no model for this. This isn't another like digital marketing company. This is really something new, unproven, like not clear if it's going to work. I mean, it's moonshotty. So I think it's actually quite good to have competitors in the market because I think it gets our investors' juices flowing a little bit in addition to ours. And I think it validates the market a little bit, which will ultimately, because we are by far the product leader, the team leader, the fundraising leader in the U.S., I think that'll be beneficial to us in the long run.
When you have a Chinese company that is, you know, I'll use my words, not your words. That sounds like they're copying you pretty closely. Do you do anything about that? Or do you just kind of grind your teeth for a little bit and then get back to building the business?
I'll be honest. I thought about putting like 100K into their latest round. But I'm the, yeah. So one, like the guy running it is a great pedigree. He was, I believe he was like the head of driver growth for Didi, the largest ride-sharing company in China. Two, their operational model, you know, is actually quite different from ours. And, you know, it has caused me to think about how ours could evolve over time. And, you know, three, you know, number three is if it were any other place, I would probably be a little salty, but because it's China, it honest to God is a market that I wasn't super interested in tackling. China is littered with the corpses of American companies that have tried and failed to do big business there. So in terms of like where we're thinking about expanding, it wasn't super high on my list. So I, you know, more than anything, like I actually think they're going to be quite successful. They have a huge advantage over us in that WeChat is omnipresent and allows mobile payments much more effectively than anything in the US right now. So I think they're gonna be successful. And I thought about trying to, you know, not seriously, but if I had the opportunity to put some money into them, I would have.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, awesome. This is absolutely fantastic. You know, I think just last question, anything you would, what one piece of advice would you give yourself if you were doing this all over again, back in the early days, or just general advice for founders? You know, I've given a ton of playbooks here. This is really useful, but anything you would do differently if you're doing this all over again?
We got lucky with a few things. Like, you have to have a co-founder. Like, I honestly, like, it just, it increases data wise, like the data shows that you have to have a co-founder. So initially I was trying to sort of do it mostly alone, and eventually I wisened up and found my co-founder, and our chances to succeed statistically and actually, you know, improve substantially. The second thing is I resisted doing the newsletter for a while. Techstars said, hey, do the newsletter, send it out monthly to investors, all the mentors that you meet, investors that pass on you, just ask them, hey, I'm sending this newsletter, keep you updated on the business. It is the best thing that I've ever done. Honestly, probably 40 to 50% of the capital that we've raised has come from, as a result of those newsletters, because we've kept people top of mind. Our lead for both rounds came as a result of the newsletter. Like, it's a great thing. It's a great hack. It'll take an hour once a month. Like, I cannot recommend doing that enough. And you can email me and I'll send you what ours looks like. It's not a fancy email. I don't bother with MailChimp. It's on a list in my Gmail. I send it out once a month and I just format it in the body of the Gmail. But it's honestly the best thing that we've done. So I would have started doing that, probably more quickly.
That's great. Yeah. Oh, that's powerful. Great. Well, any call to action for the viewers of this, I guess just check out, getcargo.com, correct? Or getcargo today.
Yeah, getcargo.today. We probably will invest in .com soon. Actually, that's what I would do over. Do not go with like a weird top level domain. It causes email issues. Your filters will reject you. Nobody can remember it. People think you're super janky. Do not go with .today. My team hates me for it. We're trying to, cargo.com is now, you know, 1.2 million to buy it or something. Like, so we go with a regular domain name.
That's good. That's good. All right. Well, getcargo.today. Check it out. All right, Jeff, this has been really, really good. I appreciate your time, and best of luck for continued success. Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate it. That was fun.